Welcome to Inside Economics. I'm Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and I'm joined by a few of my colleagues, my trusty co-host, Marissa DiNatale. Marissa, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Mark? Good afternoon.
Not too bad. Been traveling much of the week, but returned yesterday, and good to be here in Pennsylvania on a beautiful sunny day, really.
Did you go
beautiful.
Anywhere good?
Yeah, I'm on the board of MGIC. That's a large mortgage insurer. So I was in Milwaukee. I go there a couple times a year, and I love Milwaukee. Great.
Really?
Great. Yeah, it's a great city. Very livable. Great. I think a great place to raise a family. It's really a wonderful place. And the interesting thing is MGIC's headquarters are right next to Fiserv Convention Center, I guess.
And that's where Forum.
Forum. Oh yeah, you know that because you're a basketball fan, I'm sure. So you're watching the Milwaukee Bucks. But the RNC, the Republican National Committee, is holding their convention there in July. So MGIC's headquarters are kind of in a very strategic location and high demand, that kind of thing. It was a good meeting. We're missing Chris. Where's Chris? Oh, and that was Adam, by the way. Adam Kamens. Hey, Adam, how are you?
Good. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, and you've been on Inside Economics before.
I've been a couple of times. Actually, Chris has missed a couple of times I've been on, so I'm starting to get a little insulted.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not here.
You're our Chris replacement.
Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got more hair than you do, though.
That's true.
Yeah, at least on TV. I'm not sure, you know.
I think in real life, too.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And who invited you on?
I think you did.
I did? Okay. Why are you here exactly?
Because of that invitation.
Okay.
I'm here to talk about here to talk about demographics. Mostly, I think I'll be talking about domestic migration.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You do this really cool work with the Equifax based credit file data. We can track the address changes of individuals, clearly based on anonymized data, but nonetheless. And you can, it's real time. I mean, it feels real time, right? We have data through March of this year on migration flows. So, yeah. We also have Laura Ratz. Laura, good to see you.
Good to see you.
I hear you're a bit of a prima donna, though. We got to watch out for you. No? You're just the first time on Inside Economics. And Adam said you needed two nights at a hotel, preferably something comparable to the Ritz-Carlton, you know, something like that.
Well, you know, I got an 18-month-old, so, you know, I got to.
Definitely.
I need some solitude. I got a barking dog. You know, it's for your benefit that I made those demands.
I totally get it. I'm all for it. Well, it's good to have you. And you're going to be talking about foreign immigration, another aspect of the demographic picture that's really key. So
yep.
Glad to have you here. And we are doing a lot of work in this area. And it's a bit of a bear, isn't it? They're trying to incorporate these new immigration assumptions into our modeling and forecasting.
Bear is the right word.
Bear is the right word. Yeah. And you're leading the charge. Okay. Well, before we dive into the demographic issues, let's talk about the economy and the data this week. And Marissa, maybe I'll turn to you. What struck you as the most important statistic of the past week?
GDP for the first quarter of the year came out showed that the economy slowed between the fourth quarter and the first quarter of this year. So it was 1.6% annualized in the first quarter. That's down from 3.4% at the end of last year. Consumer spending, yet again, was the largest contributor to growth, as it typically is. That contributed 1.7 percentage points to GDP growth. Fixed investment was up. Detractors from growth. So the reason growth slowed so much between the fourth and the first quarters was that there was a drag from inventories. So the change in inventories was lower than the change in the fourth quarter. And also international trade was a negative for growth this past quarter. And that's the first time that that's happened in well over a year. One thing to note is that investment was up and fixed residential investment. So this is investment in housing structures, contributed about half a percentage point to GDP growth. And that was the strongest contribution to GDP growth in quite some time. The government contribution to GDP growth slowed quite a bit. So that contributed less than it has. You know, that's been a strong contributor in the last 6 to 9 months to GDP growth, government spending. It was a much smaller contribution this quarter. So this reading was a bit below what we were expecting. It was below consensus forecasts, but I mean, still, if you look at the trajectory of GDP over the past year or so, you know, we were growing well above potential for the past 6 months, the last half of 2023. This kind of brings GDP growth back down to something a bit closer to potential.
Yeah, I mean, abstracting from the vagaries of the quarterly data, what do you think the underlying growth rate is in terms?
I think it's around two.
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give or take. So, and two is, as you say, the economy's potential rate of growth, that rate of growth that is consistent with enough job creation to keep unemployment stable. And of course, unemployment's been stable now for 2 years at sub 4%.
Yeah.
So this doesn't change your view of that. This data, this report we got, doesn't change your view of that at all.
No, we were expecting a slowdown. It slowed a bit more than we were expecting, but I don't think it changes our outlook or our assessment of where the economy is heading for the next year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the slowdown was, as you said, a bigger reduction in inventories, a bigger increase in the trade deficit, largely right. Due to more imports, which goes back to strong consumer demand.
Yep.
And some weakness in decline in federal government spending. Mm-hmm. Although there's a kind of a measurement quirk there. It's very closely quarter to quarter movements are very closely tied, believe it or not, to oil prices, because that affects the deflator used to calculate real government spending. And so when you have oil prices move up like they have in the first quarter, that'll push down the measure of real government spending. I mean, I think nominal federal government spending is soft anyway, but then you throw in the mix this increase in the deflator due to oil prices, you get that decline. So if those are things that feel more or less one-off-ish, temporary, they're not going to continue. So yeah, it was on the soft side, but you know, abstracting from you know those measurement and one-off factors, it feels like we're still kind of right down the strike zone here, right?
I think so. I mean, consumer spending right below 2%. You know, it's been a bit above 2%, a little bit below 2% for the past several quarters. So that's the real driver here. And that looks good. And investment actually increased, you know, investment actually accelerated over compared to the past several quarters. So really the fundamentals of the economy, consumer spending and business spending look very solid to me.
Yeah. Hey, Adam, I know you look at this data too. Any comments on the GDP number?
I had the same impression Marissa did. I thought that, right, it seemed like the factors that were dragging it lower are not kind of structural concerns. I mean, I think it's also worth keeping in mind, right, the strength of the labor market in the first quarter kind of juxtaposed with that number. I mean, it gives me more reassurance that, I mean, there's nothing to be overly worried about Q1.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was, there's a whole plethora of data, GDP kind of top of the list. What's next on the list, Marissa?
Well, I would look at inflation next, right? So we got the PCE deflator. That was up 0.3% over the month in March. That's the same reading we got in February, slightly lower than we got in January. The core PCE was also up 0.3%. So we're looking at year-over-year PCE inflation, and this is the Fed's preferred measure of inflation as opposed to looking at CPI, right? So year-over-year, the total PCE is up 2.7% and core is up 2.8%. And I'll also note the gap between the CPI and the PCE widened a bit this month too. So markets didn't really like this inflation report. You know, we saw mortgage rates rise. We saw bond yields rise on this report. So, but it didn't accelerate, which is good news. And I want to point out housing, right? This is what we've been laser focused on as being the major source of inflation. So house prices, housing costs in the PCE stayed the same over the month. The housing and utilities prices rose 0.5% over the month, which is the same as they rose in February. So no acceleration there. So here again, it's not, it'd be nice to get an inflation report that shows a clear deceleration in inflation. We didn't get that. We got steady. I guess it's better than the alternative of an acceleration in inflation.
Yeah. Well, so when we got the GDP number, that was on Thursday. Today's Friday. So on the Thursday, April 25th, we got an estimate of the consumer expenditure deflator, the core piece, so-called core consumer expenditure deflator, core PCE, ex food and energy, which is what the Federal Reserve targets. That's when they talk about, when you talk about the 2% inflation target, that's the measure that's being used. And it came in strong. I think it grew 3.7% annualized, and the markets really didn't like that. That's, we had a bad day. Stock prices were down, bond yields were up, the kind of thing on Thursday. But here on Friday, we got the monthly estimate of the core PCE for March, and that came in at 0.3, as you say. Just because listeners of the podcast know we're going to the second significant digit, 0.32. People calmed down a bit. Investors calmed down because there was some, most of the increase in the quarter happened in January. That's when we saw the big pop, and that's probably mostly related to measurement issues, because that's when you go to the new calendar year, a lot of companies raise their prices, very difficult to seasonally adjust for that. And now the 0.3 is still, you know, you want 0.2, maybe 0.1 every once in a while thrown in. You don't want 0.3, but 0.3 isn't hair on fire, and therefore right. The markets are having a much better day. Obviously, lots of other things going on, earnings from some of the tech companies has been pretty good. So you get, but you're, you know, that really helped. So if you look at bond yields, it's kind of your barometer of how people are thinking about these inflation statistics. Feels the bond yields are down today. Stock prices are up. You know, you add up to both days and we kind of, no change. We're kind of where we started, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I think they saw the GDP report and they were backing out what they thought PCE inflation would be, right? And they were worried about that. Now they see the monthly numbers. It's calmed down a bit.
Calmed down a bit, right. And my, you know, I know I've said this many times, but I'll say it again. A lot of the difference, if not all of the difference, maybe even more than all of the difference between what core PCE is now, and on a year over year basis, it's 2.8%. And the target 2%, so that 0.8 percentage point difference, that 80 basis point difference, is the growth in the cost of housing services for homeowners, the so-called owner's equivalent rent, the implicit cost of owning a home. If you exclude that, and I would strongly argue we should be when trying to think about monetary policy, because it's impossible to measure. But by the way, it's impossible to measure at any, in normal times. It's like, forget about it in the current situation when the housing market is as upside down as it is today. But even more significantly, this is an obvious point, but just to articulate it, homeowners' actual cost of owning the home isn't rising, because most homeowners have a mortgage. They don't have a mortgage. 40% of homeowners don't have a mortgage. The other 60% have a mortgage, but almost all of that is 30-year fixed rate debt that they locked in at 3.5%. And so their mortgage payments aren't rising. So isn't their cost of living isn't really rising? It's not really rising.
Their real cost of housing has actually fallen given today's prevailing mortgage rates, given what they have, right?
Yeah.
The gap between the effective mortgage rate and the prevailing mortgage rate right now is huge, just because we know that, you know, 75-80% of them have a mortgage below 4%.
Yeah. I mean, I think the average coupon out there is 3.5. Maybe it's migrated up a little bit. But so my point is that if you really want to understand what underlying inflation is, which I think is what the Fed wants to target, right, ultimately, something they have some control over, it's you need to exclude OER. And if you do, we're there. We're at target, you know, firmly at target, at that 2% target, with no magic tricks. You know, I'm not making stuff up. I'm not, you know, doing anything other than saying we want to get the underlying inflation, and you have to exclude OER Which, by the way, the Europeans do in their measure of inflation. They don't use OER because it's, as I said, pretty difficult, if not impossible, to measure. Adam, I see you shaking your head. Anything you want to comment on there? Or you're just agreeing with me?
I'm mostly just agreeing and also contemplating how my statistic may or may not have just been compromised.
Okay. You probably shouldn't have told us that.
Happens a lot here.
Yeah, I know. I know. I've got a plan B. But. Yeah,
I got a plan B. Good. We always need a plan B and a plan C. Plan C. Okay. Any other statistic you want to call out that came out this week, Marissa?
I mean, we got spending data. Yeah. We got personal income data, and both of those were quite strong. They were both up 0.5 percentage point over the month. So again, the consumer looks solid, right? I mean, certainly there are headwinds, mostly stemming from inflation that we're talking about. We have gas prices that are higher now. We have high costs of housing and food still. These things are deflating, but consumer spending and personal income look good over the month. And then we got job market data too, right? We once again keep joking about this, but the unemployment insurance claims, like, they're just not changing. It's like a straight line. Nothing. In fact, I think they fell a bit over the week. Yeah, they were down by 5,000 claims. So they're down to 207, which is just incredibly low, right?
207,000 unemployment insurance claims, initial claims.
Per week, right. Yeah, as of last week. So just no signs of surging layoffs or layoffs picking up in any of the data that we're looking at.
Well, it's funny. I am on Twitter at Mark Zandi. Just saying.
I think it's called X now, Mark.
Oh yeah, X. I'm on X at Mark Zandi. What was I going to say about that? The fact that unemployment insurance claims. I think if you take a 4-week moving average, I think they've been 210,000 on the nose. For like, I don't know, I'm making this up, 4, 6, 8 weeks, something like that. So on X, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories going around.
Oh, that's shocking.
Right? BLS is making this up. How can it be so close? And I'm thinking to myself, well, if they really were going to make this up, wouldn't they create a little bit of variation, you know, in the numbers? So it's a really bad conspiracy if they're just picking 210,000 and just writing that in. But I thought that was pretty funny. But that goes to the remarkable, probably unprecedented, we should take a look, unprecedented stability in that number. I've never seen anything like it. Just rock solid 200.
Yeah, I'm looking at a chart of it. And since September of last year, it's kind of just, you know, little movements, right? But it hasn't gone anywhere since summer of last year.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. And at the end of the day, as long as businesses are not laying off workers, the economy is going to continue to push forward. I think a necessary condition for recession is layoffs, and that's just not happening.
Absolutely.
Just not happening. Hey, talking about conspiracy theories, did you see that Wall Street Journal article about folks in the former President Trump's camp thinking about ways to capture the Fed? In fact, I think one of the ideas that was being discussed or has been discussed, and again, this is coming from the Wall Street Journal, is that the president should have the ability to review any interest rate changes before they actually occur. Did you guys see that report?
Yes.
Yeah. Did I get that right? Did I summarize
it? A bit disturbing.
Make sure. Did I get it right?
I mean, essentially... there's a group of Trump advisors that have put together a 10-page outline for how they would rejigger the Fed, which basically would give the president, basically would put the president at the head of the FOMC for all intents and purposes, right? He would have final sign-off and consultation on any changes in monetary policy. He could use the Treasury Department to his will in terms of expanding and contracting the money supply. He could, you know, rearrange the makeup of the, which of course he can do, right? He can place whoever he wants as the chairperson of the Fed. That he would be consulted on all monetary policy decisions.
Wow. What do you think of that?
I think it's terrible. Yeah. It's scary. I mean, the pillar of our monetary system is an independent Federal Reserve. This is not supposed to be political in any way, and we're talking about completely politicizing the economy and the financial system.
Yeah, I mean, I think politics, it's hard to say, you can't say politics don't play some role in how the Federal Reserve conducts policy, because at the end of the day, they are beholden to Congress and the American people. So they have to be cognizant of the political situation. So, for example, I think it's very possible that the data might be saying, let me put it this way, if there was no presidential election, the data would be arguing by September that the Fed should be cutting rates. But if you get to September and you haven't cut rates, and you've got a November election a few weeks away, are you really going to cut interest rates at that September meeting? Because you will clearly be brought into the political process. You will clearly be politicized. And do you really, is that in the best interest of the Federal Reserve longer run, maintaining that independence? The answer is probably not. So all else being equal, you'll probably wait to actually cut interest rates. So
but that's all in an effort to try to remain apolitical, right? And I guess what you're arguing is
exactly
maybe what they should do is not what they will do because they are cognizant of any political blowback, which I agree with. But they're doing it, I think, not because they want to give one guy an advantage over another. They don't want any impression that that could be what they're doing, right? Here totally. We're talking about a politician actually having control over monetary policy.
And isn't that a major risk to inflation in the long run, right? Because what politician is ever going to condone raising interest rates?
That's the point. That's why we have independent central banks, because we could never get inflation was, a real problem. And that's why globally, countries everywhere, even countries with autocratic governments have central banks that are largely independent. It varies, obviously, from place to place. In those countries that don't, like in Argentina, I'm just throwing that out there, they got an inflation problem, because you're right. It's a lot easier to cut rates than to raise rates. And your proclivity is going to be always cutting rates. And if that's the case, then you're likely going to end up with inflation that's uncomfortably high, and be a problem. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that a independent central bank, Federal Reserve, is a necessary condition for a well-functioning economy, market economy. That I don't think it works without one. Ultimately, it'll just break. Now, hopefully, if anybody decides they want to go down the path of trying to capture the Fed and politicize it and change the conduct of policies, so it revolves around politics than the economics, investors would throw up all over that, right? I mean, interest rates would, I would think, right? We're not the only ones would conclude this is going to be more inflation. So if you're a bond investor, you'd say, okay, go have at it, but now you got to pay me a much higher interest rate for that. And then, of course, an equity investor is going to say, oh, interest rates are a lot higher, so price earnings multiples in the market are lower, so stock prices are going to go down. So it just feels like the result is going to be a lot more days with a lot of red on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine the chaos in financial markets something like this would cause.
Yeah. Although, it's one of those things, it could be one of these things that, like a boiling pot, it just changes slowly over time. The Fed gets captured over time, and there's no like catalytic event. It's like, you're okay, and then you're not okay, and it's too late. It's too late. I don't know. But anyway, hopefully we don't go. Hopefully this is just talk. Fine. Talk right. All you want, but hopefully that's what this is. Okay, anything else on the economic front you want to bring up, Marissa?
So we talked about spending, GDP, house prices. We got the Moody's Analytics house price index. That was up almost 6% over the month in March, year over year.
Amazing.
Very strong. Down a bit from where it was in February, 6.1 in February. But yeah, we're still looking at 6% year over year house price increases nationally, with most markets rising. A few notable ones posting declines, but yeah, there's not a lot of inventory out there. It's a tale as old as time at this point, as we talked about. Nobody's moving. It's keeping a floor under house prices.
You know what I found interesting, and maybe Adam, you saw this too in the data. This is our repeat sales index. So we all the transactions in the country every month. We know from courthouse records, we know the price, and then we take a look at that price on a home and look at what the price was the last time that home transacted. And then we add that all up and create an index by market. And the interesting thing that I found very interesting is the strongest price gains, guess where they are? They're in the Northeast and Midwest, which is pretty atypical.
Philadelphia is one of the top.
Philly's doing really well. New York City. Philly. I saw the Shore Ocean County, New Jersey, which is where we go to the beach on July 4th. I think, like I saw, and this may be just a data issue, 20% year-over-year growth. Can you believe that? Yeah.
I'd be careful with Ocean County, New Jersey. There's all kinds of quirks with at least the employment data for there. Okay. But I believe the rest of what you're saying for the Northeast. Yeah. I mean, we've seen a lot of this out migration from the Northeast, from big cities. That has slowed really dramatically. I've actually got an interesting stat on Philly. If we go to the Equifax data, which we'll talk about more. So let's talk about it now
because this is a great segue into this part of the conversation. Yeah, the demographic conversation. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so maybe I'll just give a little context on the Equifax data for people who aren't familiar with it, right? Mm-hmm. That it's a 10% cut of the Equifax credit file where we're able to track changes of address, right? I think you mentioned already it's anonymized, but we are able from that to back out kind of the degree to which people are moving within the U.S. So we have in-migration, out-migration for every metro area for 7 different age cuts. And then we also have data on metro to metro patterns. So we know how many people like left, you know, Philadelphia, went to New York and vice versa in each month. So what I was going to say about it actually is there is what the vast majority of metro areas in the US, right, just overall movement has declined pretty sharply over the last couple of years, right? And especially in 2023, just given the effect of high interest rates and
the lock-in
effect. Exactly. There's one of the top 75 metro area divisions, the 75 largest. There's only one where actually the number of people moving in kind of gross. So not a net number, just number volume of people moving in has risen from 2022 to 2023.
It's not Philly, is it?
It's Philly.
When you say Philly, so what are the counties you're in?
Philadelphia County and Delaware County.
Metro Division. Metro Division. Okay. Yeah. More. Wait a second. So this is in migration.
Just in migration. The other 74, even places where people have been moving in rapidly, right? You have fewer people moving in and fewer people moving out, and so they might be looking good on net, but only Philly actually had more people move in 2023 than move in 2022.
And where are they coming from?
A lot of them are just coming actually from the suburbs. So a lot of them coming from like the mainline suburbs, maybe moving back in. I have a feeling you might have some younger people who are, maybe were living at home for a little while and,
My sister. She's now living in Fiddler Square? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's some of it. I mean, we are seeing some movement still from New York, some other expensive areas where people have been moving in for a while into Philly. So I think it's kind of that combination. I think you have some people coming back in from suburbs, some people from the New York, New Jersey area, but
it's affordable, right?
I mean, and it's affordable. Relatively, that's the big difference.
Nothing's affordable, but it's relatively affordable compared to New York and DC.
Exactly. I think that's the big difference, right? These big cities are faring a lot better over the past year or so than they were in 2020, but even compared to 2021, 2022, but they're still expensive. So they're, it's still hard to draw people to move in large numbers. But Philly, to your point, is affordable enough that you, I think you do have some people coming in from some of the more expensive big cities in the Northeast, or even seeing a little bit of migration from, you know, some other markets within the US to Philly. So it's a pretty encouraging story for our hometown.
Well, what about net though? I mean, because that's, you net, say in, then you have yeah. out, and the difference is that is net in migration. Yeah. So what's net in migration like?
So it, I think Philly is experiencing net also improved, right? I think yeah. out, I believe out fell a little bit, Philly out fell most places. So the net story, this isn't that in and out both kind of moved up at the same clip. Philly is, I looked at this before, I think the most improved metro area from 2022 to 2023, no surprise, is San Francisco, just because it was bleeding residents and it's just bleeding fewer residents, basically.
Yeah.
I believe Philly was number three on the
but
list.
But is it
I can't
negative?
Remember what number two is.
Is net migration negative or positive?
I think it is still negative.
Still negative. It's just less negative on
less
a
negative
basis.
Than it was. Yeah, it's improving almost as rapidly as anywhere else. And it's compared to the other ones that are improving really quickly, it's in a much better starting position than, say, a San Francisco.
You know, we went right to the into the weeds. I mean, immediately into the weeds. Maybe can we just take one big step back and can you give us a sense of what the data is saying more broadly about domestic migration? Well, but thing number one, you said that it's really important and very consistent with everything else, is that the number of people are moving is down. So we're not seeing as much in or out migration just because there's just people are locked in. They got a 3.5% mortgage. The mortgage rate's 7. They can't move or the economic doesn't make economic sense. And so we're just seeing fewer moves. So that's one thing you've observed. What else have you observed in the data?
Sure. Yeah. No, there's a bunch. And yeah,
bunch of stuff?
I can't help
okay.
myself. I can't help myself jump right into the weeds. It's yeah. I live in the
yeah,
weeds.
We go right down to block level in, you know, Philadelphia. Yeah. So,
yeah. So if we
but,
zoom
but
out,
anyone out there should know, I mean, this is a rare thing for Philadelphia. I mean, like I've lived here all my life and never have I felt the city as good as it feels today. I mean, that I know that's a very anecdotal, squishy thing to say, but it's true, and you can kind of see it in the data, right? Broadly. But okay, I digress. Let's go broad again. Go ahead.
Sorry, when I saw that data point, I figured I yeah. had to give that to you, Mark. Yeah, I figured you'd right. eat that up. But yeah. I think big picture. So what the data show us, I mean, first of all, no surprise, right? People have been migrating out of
and
the
by the
Northeast,
way, one more point, one more quick sure. point. I can't resist this either. My view is that the presidential election is going to boil down to Philly. I'll just leave it at that. Go ahead.
Well, if people keep
and
moving
I'm not joking.
In, then you might be right. Maybe yeah. maybe it'll be half yeah. the country by the time.
I'm not joking.
The year.
I'm not joking.
It did.
Okay.
It did last time, didn't it? I mean,
did it? I mean, it certainly must have played a big role. Right?
It was definitely a big part of.
Yeah. Wasn't Chester County one of yeah. the major determining yeah. counties?
Yeah, Chester County, yeah. Delaware County,
Montgomery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
there were a lot of memes on the topic. Or
we're just trying to make ourselves feel important, you know. But anyway, go ahead. I'll leave you alone, Adam. Go ahead.
I wonder if we should construct a model where people move into an area just so that their vote can be the deciding vote. Maybe that's the motivation. Yeah.
That's an interesting concept. Maybe.
So.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
go ahead.
All right. So I guess the big, if I really zooming out, right, the big picture with migration has been for as long as this data set goes back, and even before that, and this data goes back to about 2005, right, there's been movement out of the Northeast, out of the Midwest, into the South, and into the Mountain West. And after the pandemic, that picked up dramatically, right? You saw a lot more movement out of big cities, into the Mountain West, into the Southeast in particular. I'm not saying anything anybody here hasn't heard a million times already, but what we've seen in the most recent data over the last year and a half has been much slower movement into the Mountain West. A lot of these kind of secondary, tertiary markets, the Boise's of the world in particular, have really seen a marked slowdown in migration. We've seen actually, the Southeast is still doing very well. There is, I won't keep quizzing you, but the state that looks like it's adding residents at the most rapid clip on a per capita basis is South Carolina.
I was going to say that. That's not fair. I was going to definitely say that.
So I didn't want to quiz you. I didn't want to give you too much satisfaction here. So South Carolina is growing really rapidly. We really aren't seeing any real meaningful deceleration in the Southeast. And so those are kind of the two broad trends among the kind of areas of the country that are kind of the winners demographically. And then the other kind of broad pattern we're seeing is that like I mentioned before, big cities, these gateway markets that were losing residents really rapidly, in 2021, 2022, they look a lot more like they did in 2018, 2019, which is to say they're still losing residents, but it's not anywhere near the clip that they were.
So the pandemic hits, we see the mass outflow of people from these large urban centers. The net migration was negative and deeply negative and getting more negative. I think that kind of peaked in 2022. No, am I right?
More like, I'd say 2021. 2021, but it probably was near its peak still, and we got to 2022. And
yeah, late 21, early 22.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's kind of the peak of the the remote work dynamic, and then remote work started to come back in a little bit. Businesses say, "Hey, you got to come back to work in person," mm-hmm. and that net outflow has slowed. And last time I looked, the amount of net out migration is still a bit elevated relative to the pre-pandemic period. Is that correct, or is it all the way back into pre-pandemic?
It is almost all the way back.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it depends on the market too. So San Francisco still looks a bit worse than it did prior to the pandemic. New York looks pretty similar. So it depends. I mean, the one thing I would say too, though, I wouldn't put all of my stock in that, because you see like daytime population. So if you look at commuter traffic, office vacancy rates, it's clear that these big urban centers, there's not as much activity. The economies are not as robust, especially on weekdays, as they were prior to the pandemic. But in terms of just people moving in and out, it looks very similar to 2018, 2019.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've got this, you go, I visit all these, I told you, I said I was in Milwaukee, and Milwaukee is a good case in point. The office towers are, the occupancy rates are a lot lower than they were pre-pandemic. Although I'd say Milwaukee, the remote work dynamic hasn't played out quite as significantly as in a place like New York or Philly or San Francisco. But nonetheless, it has happened. So you have fewer people coming into the office every day, yet you've got these large apartment towers going up everywhere for people. It feels like, how do you square that? I mean,
so they're moving into a city, but they're working remotely from their home in the city. They're not going into.
Is that what's going on?
I mean, it sounds I don't know. Sounds like what you're saying.
I would think, I mean, we've seen in a lot of the data, right, the people that are moving back into cities generally are, that was actually one of the other trends that we're seeing consistently in this Equifax data, is it's the young adults, right? The 18 to 34 year old cohort is generally pretty pumped about city living again. And so a lot of them are, I think Marissa, I think you're right. They're moving into, these urban apartments, and they're moving there not to be close to where they work, but because they're attracted to the way of life, and they want the amenities, they want the nightlife, they want all that. I mean, they're kind of agnostic about where they live relative to their office location, because a lot of them are working remote jobs anyway.
I mean, that struck me at our All Hands Day, a couple weeks ago, we were all together in the suburbs of Philly. How many of our younger colleagues were telling me that they all recently moved into the city? They all live in Philadelphia, and a lot of them live near each other, and they're there not because their job is there, but because they want to be in a city.
An interesting conversation a couple of weeks ago about this, where offices that are located in cities, that I was talking to a group, and a few of them work in offices located in cities, I think particularly in DC. And they were saying the people that go into the office regularly are the young people. because it's, you know, it's near them. And then I was saying, well, my experience, right, I think our experience with kind of a more suburban office is that generally it's been some of the more experienced people that, right, the younger people, at least that I have worked with and on my team, they don't want to go anywhere near the office if they don't have to. So I think I think all of that, right, it's sort of the people, the office occupancy and kind of who's going in is just a function of where it's located. And I think basically, if you want young people around, you kind of need to follow them into cities.
So this whole idea that remote work and the hollowing out of these office towers was going to be the death knell of these urban cores, maybe not. It's just a reshuffling. It's an adjustment process, obviously, but it's a kind of a reshuffling. That and the city's going to end up being just more residential. This is a place to live as opposed to a place to work. Yeah,
that's exactly right. I think that and a place to travel for, you know, I think tourism is still very popular in a lot of these cities. But yeah, it's a place people go to have fun as opposed to go to work. And
yeah, I mean, like Philadelphia, you've got the professional sports, you've got universities having basketball tournaments, you've got all kinds of performing arts all the time. Yeah, it's interesting. That's very interesting. Okay. So
can I ask a question about the other part of what Adam said about people moving to the South and the South Carolina?
Sure. Yeah.
Anecdote. So Adam, who's doing that? Is this sort of the baby boom retiree migration to the South that's going on, or is this also younger people?
I think it's a little of both. I think though, in the case of South Carolina, I think there is an outsized share that is the retirees moving there. So like Myrtle Beach, Hilton Head, those are really popular destinations. And I think a lot of that is being driven by retirees, but there is, I think Greenville was another one in another metro area in South Carolina that's been very popular with movers. And I think that's more balanced, right? I think there are young workers that are following jobs there. So it's a mix, but I think the South Carolina example in particular, I think it does skew more towards seniors and retirees. I think you're seeing other areas like, you know, whether it's Nashville or Raleigh-Durham or Jacksonville, where it's more young people that are migrating to those areas.
Okay. Any other trends in the data you want to call out, Adam, before we move to the stats game and we start talking about foreign immigration with Laura?
I think those are the key ones. I'm sure we'll circle back to some, but those are probably the biggest observations I've seen so far.
Okay. Very good. Well, let's play the stats game. The game is we each put forward a statistic. The rest of the group tries to figure that out through clues and questions, deductive reasoning. The best stat is one that's not so easy. We get it immediately. Not one that's not so hard. We never get it. And if it's apropos to the topic at hand, demographics or recent economic data, all the better. And we always begin with Marissa. Marissa, you're up.
Okay. 3.6% year over year.
In the GDP numbers?
No.
In the inflation numbers?
No. But it's inflation related.
Is it wage growth?
No.
Is it housing related?
Yes.
Is it house price related? No.
Rent?
Yes.
Rent?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ah.
I'm going to tell you what it is, because I kind of went a little bit off the grid for this.
Okay.
Because this is data from Zillow. Wait,
by the way, congratulations. That was very good, Adam. I did all the work and then you got the answer.
Hey, it's a role reversal, right? Isn't that you? Don't listen to the other one?
It only matters who buzzes in at the end with the correct
answer. I agree. So rent growth is 3.6% year over year. Okay, explain.
So this is Zillow's. Yeah, this is data from Zillow, right? So we're having this conversation about rent price growth and OER showing up in the official inflation statistics put out by the government. We know there's a lag between when real-time rents get signed and when that shows up. So this is, Zillow has a data point that they put out every month. It's a repeat purchase rent index. It includes all kinds of rents. So it includes people renting single-family homes, people renting multifamily, you know, apartments. So the latest reading that came out in April showed that rent prices were up, rents were up 3.6% over the year. If we go back a year ago, so if we look at the data that came out in April of 2023, rents were growing 5.8% over the year. So this has come way in. But what's kind of interesting is that if you look over the past few months, rents have sort of started to accelerate a little bit. So the bottom of this Zillow repeat rent index was showing rents growing at 3.3% toward the end of last year. And we're now up to 3.6%, which suggests there could be a little bit of, you know, rent acceleration in some markets. But the broader point I want to make is that this is way, way down. Whether you look at it from a year ago or you go back several years, you know, if you go back to 2022, we were looking at rent growth of 16% year over year on the same month. So 16% in 2022, almost 6% last year, and now we're looking at a little bit over 3.5% now.
Yeah, I don't like the Zillow data on rent.
Okay.
I think that's the listed rent. It's not the actual
transacted rent.
It's not the actual effective rent. Yeah. And if you go look at, I think I have that right. Someone should just check to make sure. I think if you look at like apartmentlist.com, which I find much preferable because that goes to the effective rent that people are paying, the actual rent that they're paying. And you look at that data, the most recent data, and again, this is from my mind's eye, so I don't know if I'm exactly right, but it is definitely not up at all. If anything, it's, you know, down, still down. Not a lot. You know, it's not. It's,
you mean it's a negative number?
It's a negative number.
I see.
It's a negative number. So I'm skeptical of the Zillow data. I don't know that I would focus on that. Adam, do you have or Laura, do you have a view on that data? Have you looked at it at all?
I've looked at it a little bit, but I don't. Yeah. I've not gotten
into the weeds
enough to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have that right. Chris would know if he were here. I think that's the case. But anyway, your broader point is that it's decelerating. The level may be a high relative to the actual rent, but the pace of growth is decelerating here.
That's right. And if you look at, if you go to the pre-pandemic, right? So if we looked at like March of 2019, compared to here, rents are, you know, I was looking at that compared to the CPI, rents are up almost like by a third, according to the Zillow data. If you look at the CPI data for rent of shelter over that time period, they're up like 27%. So we're talking about roughly between a quarter and a third of rent price appreciation since the pandemic started. So, you know, we're still have high housing costs, right, relative to where we were. It's just coming in.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying because of the surge
cumulatively,
in rents.
Right. Yeah. Cumulatively, since the start of the pandemic, rents are up by somewhere around 30%, depending on the source.
I kind of in my mind's eye, before the pandemic, the kind of the typical rent, you know, for like a single bedroom was like $1,000 a month. Again, I'm making all this up, but roughly speaking, now I think it's like $1,250 a month, you know, something like that. And so
The Zillow median was like almost 2,000 a month as of this March, compared to about 1,900 a month. Yeah.
That may be the other thing. Zillow might be at the high end of the market than the total market. I this feels like it. If that's the median is 1,900 bucks, I would think that sounds high for the entire market. But anyway, that's a good one though. That's a really good one. Laura, do you want to go next?
Sure. I have two. I was trying to keep mine within my topic of immigration.
That is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. So do you want the easy one or the more obscure one? The easy one might be two.
Let's see how easy it really is. Someone says it's easy. It's not easy, but go
ahead. I'm going to say it might be, and Adam, I might have to ban you from guessing until a few moments go by, but I don't know, maybe
not. Quiet.
Mine's a year. 2040. Mine is a year, actually.
Oh.
In which something will happen. 2040.
When a minority population outpaces the white population?
No, but in that realm, yeah.
In that realm.
Like, you mean it's
you're on the right
when
track.
When the foreign the born track. Is high, no, that can't be. Foreign born won't outpace native born by 2040. That can't be it, right? That's not it.
So it's the year per the CBO estimates, which we're all really invested in right now. That is the year at which natural population growth will cease to support overall population growth, and immigration will be the sole source of U.S. population growth.
That's a good one.
Oh,
so you're saying
good, yeah.
You got it like in 3 seconds.
You're saying if there was no immigration, then by 2040, the U.S. population will start to decline.
No. Well, yes. If immigration went to zero in 2040.
Yeah. If immigration was zero, the natural births and deaths would
natural population change will go negative. Deaths will outpace births.
Right. Yeah. That actually is a very good one. So 2040. So that's 16 years from now. That'll be the case.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one estimate. You know, there are others that put it a little bit sooner, actually.
Oh. What about the minority versus the white population? I think I got that roughly right. It could be
that I can't say for sure, but I would say it's around the same time.
Around the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Why don't you give us the hard one?
I would think sooner. Yeah. Or so.
I mean, it's already the case in California.
Yeah. It's already pretty close. Yeah.
What is already the case?
That the non-white population is larger than the white population.
White population.
Yeah.
Right. You want to give us the hard one?
The hard one.
The hard one
is too hard.
Well, if we had talked about immigration already, let's do that at the end.
Yeah, let's just save it because Marissa's got to leave a little early anyway. Yeah. So
we don't want to deprive Adam his turn.
Yeah, exactly. Adam, what's your stat?
All right, I will say because I know I don't want to take too long. I'll give you one that it might be a little bit easy because it kind of goes back to something we were talking about before. But let's go to the 3.781%.
Wow. Three digits on that one.
Three digits. I'm upping the ante.
Is it demographic related?
No. Well, it will come back to a point about demographics, but this is not specifically
OER?
A demographic. It is not, but you're in the ballpark. It's housing related.
Housing related. 3.781%. Year is it year over year growth?
Is this a growth rate?
It's not a growth rate.
It's a proportion of something.
It's a rate of something.
It's a rate. Is that that's not the share of the population that moves in a given year, is it? Oh no, that's demographic.
No, it's that was a statistic I wanted to go to, but it was hard to find. Well, I'll get into that.
It's hard to find, yeah.
Yeah.
Housing related.
Is the three decimal points, is that telling? Like, should that?
Yeah, is that?
Just how it's reported.
Okay, so that is how it's reported.
And I will tell you, it's from, I believe it's from the bowels of the GDP report.
Oh. So it's something to do with, is that the mortgage rate, the effective mortgage rate?
Yeah, yeah, it's the effective mortgage rate.
The effective mortgage
For
outstanding mortgages, which is actually down slightly from
from
Q4. It's almost flat, but so I was surprised that it was down. I'm not sure if that's just sort of a statistical anomaly. It's only about, a hundredth of a point that it's lower, but.
Yeah.
I mentioned that only to just sort of reemphasize a point that we've already kind of made here, but that gap that Marissa, that you were talking about between the effective rate and, or the effective rate
prevailing
on
rate.
Outstanding debt versus the actual kind of prevailing rate, that rate lock effect has kept people tethered to their homes. And it basically is really evident in a lot of the domestic migration data that we're seeing. And basically the mover rate, it's hard to get 2023 data, although there are some sources out there that are reporting 2023 data on the mover rate. And basically, it's not clear exactly what that number will be, but it's pretty clear it is the lowest mover rate on record, right? That goes back to the 1940s. So that, and then you combine the rate lock effect with, right, the aging population and sort of the reduced mobility associated with that. Just people aren't moving at the same clip they used to.
Yeah, yeah. You want me to give you my statistic real fast?
Yeah.
Okay, two numbers. 62%
and 62%,
yeah, and 66%. And it's actually 65.9%, but I'm rounding to 66.
Those sound like home ownership rates.
Yeah, but that's not it. But that, you're right. The home ownership rate is 66%. Yeah, but
consumption share of GDP.
No, it's demographic related.
Does that have anything to do with the labor force participation, Mark?
It does indeed.
Is it foreign-born participation?
Which
versus
one's foreign?
Native-born?
Which one's foreign-born?
What were the numbers again?
66% and 62%.
66, I will say, is foreign-born participation.
Exactly.
And 62 is native.
Very good. Excellent. Yeah, that was fantastic. Wow, yeah, very, very good, Laura.
That's funny. That was on my list. I'm wishing I had done that now. that wasn't my hard one, but that was on my list.
That's a good one. Well, 66, the participation rate for foreign born is back to pre-pandemic, and it really hasn't changed in 10 years. Mm-hmm. The native born is 62%, and that is down a bit from pre-pandemic. It was 62.5%, so we're down a little bit. And that goes back to older native born Americans leaving the workforce and not coming back. But that's another reason why foreign immigration tends to support economic growth, right? Because it's not only about people work, it lifts labor force more because it's the people and the fact that a higher share of them go into the workforce looking for work or working. But that's a good segue into the last topic that we'd like to discuss, and that's foreign immigration. And maybe, Laura, you can give us a sense of the motivation why we're focused on this. I mean, it's obvious in some respects, but in other respects, not so much. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've teased this topic a little bit before in your previous speaking events, but basically earlier this year, the CBO released new estimates on their demographic projections, and among other things, this included different immigration numbers. When I say different, I mean different than the Census Bureau, which has long been kind of the definitive source for all things demographics. And basically, going back a couple of years, the CBO is saying that immigration numbers into the U.S. have just been way, way higher than originally believed. Just for point of reference, in 2023, the Census Bureau has it at about 1.1 million immigrants came into the country. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has it at about 3.3 million, so quite a bit higher. What's really interesting about this is that it helps to explain a lot of employment data that we've been seeing. And if you go back, the past couple of years, this discrepancy started, back in like 2021, where the CBO is estimating much higher immigration than the Census Bureau. And that's roughly around the same time that employment data started to just roll in quite a bit higher than we were expecting. And, economists were scratching their heads, and now we kind of have a better understanding of why, that there was just so many more people in the labor force to help the economy add these jobs.
Right. So CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan government agency that does the budgeting for the U.S., they have to do an economic forecast because that goes to how much revenue is going to be, tax revenue is going to be generated, what kind of government spending is going to take place to do the budget. To do a forecast of the budget. And of course, the economic outlook is very closely tied back to demographic assumptions in the long run over a 10-year horizon. And they actually go out 30 years for some of their forecasting. And foreign immigration is a big part of that. And so that's why they've been focused on this. And they have gone back, taken a look at data coming from the border and the data showing how many people are being stopped at the border by Border Patrol, because that's tracked on a monthly basis. And they've used that to construct estimates of how many folks are coming across the border. And they estimated total immigration, both legal and undocumented, at 3.3 million in 2023. If you go back pre-pandemic in the years leading up to the pandemic, typically it was closer to a million. 250K undocumented, the rest legal, you know, visas and everything else. And so that you're saying is having a big impact on the labor force and therefore on economic growth.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So if you look at the CBO forecast, so they have to do a forecast, right? Mm-hmm. They have this strong immigration continuing in 2024. It comes in a little bit in 25 into 26. I believe by 2027, 2028, it's back down to that million per annum that prevailed prior.
Yeah, just over a million.
Of course, we have to do a forecast, right? We're now in the process of incorporating these new estimates on immigration into our own estimates. So we're not going to be using census data. We're going to be using estimates that are based on the CBO methodology. And of course, we have to do a forecast, and our forecast doesn't necessarily have to be the same as CBO. In fact, it certainly won't be. What do you think is behind the CBO? And this is a high degree of speculation, but you know, let's speculate away. Under what circumstances do you think you get the CBO forecast, and do you think that's the best forecast, you know, going forward?
Sorry, I don't understand the question. Under what circumstances?
Well, okay, so gave you the CBO forecast.
So they're basically saying that, you know, this current surge will continue over the next few years. When it does start to come in a little bit, you know, they offer a variety of explanations. You know, okay. One is just that so much of this surge has been, you know, they put into the so-called other category. And, you know, that includes people that you might call illegal, but it also just includes people who, you know, they came into the country, they had an interaction with Border Patrol, but they're now in awaiting worker authorization. They're awaiting, day in court, essentially, to decide their status. That number will come in a little bit just as the system adjusts to allow for this, you know, to accommodate this surge coming into the border. You know, essentially, not as many people will be allowed in to, you know, await immigration proceedings. That's a big part of what will kind of bring that number in the next couple of years.
Meaning they're expecting a change in policy around immigration.
Policy to an extent, but just the system's wherewithal to handle that many people coming into the country.
So they'll turn more people away.
Yeah, essentially.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So the border is completely overwhelmed. People are pouring through. The Border Patrol and other resources aren't adequate to address this, and therefore we have lots of people coming in. But policymakers aren't standing still. They are working to regain control of the border and those flows. And the CBO is assuming in their forecast that is going to be successful over the course of the next several years. And as you look towards the end of the decade, immigration will be back to something that's more typical.
Yes. Yes, that's it. Sorry. I apologize if you guys can hear the dog going nuts in the
background. No, forget about the dog. It doesn't matter. Dogs everywhere. Don't worry about it.
Essentially it.
Yeah. Okay. So do you think that that's a good forecast? You know what they have? I mean, if we have to do a forecast, we haven't gotten there yet. We're in the process of going in that direction. And again, you know, this is something we have to discuss and iron out, but I'm asking you your intuition at this point. Do you think that's a good forecast going forward?
Under the current climate, yes, I think so. I think so much just depends on immigration policy. To a large extent, I feel like these latest numbers, they're kind of a smoking gun in the immigration discussion. You know, there's an argument to be made that the U.S. economy has done a lot, has done so well the past few years because of immigration. And, you know, as I said, in 16 years, the U.S. population growth will depend entirely on immigration. So I think that is a policy motivator to change things. Now, as for not this forecast is valid, yes, under the current policy environment, yes, I think so. But a lot depends on that and what changes may or may not come, probably won't come. Like,
as in, what you're not saying, but I'll just say it and you can shake your head up and down or sideways. It does depend on how the election.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But even then, immigration policy has been stuck in the weeds for decades. You know, it's going to take some significant political will to make any meaningful changes.
Well, it feels like whether it's Biden or whether it's Trump, they both want to control the border, right? That, I don't think there's a difference there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and if that's the biggest part of the surge in immigration, then under both—
Which it is, yeah. Either way, yeah. Well, and that's exactly what the CBO is forecasting, is that it, you know, in time, the system will get a better handle on it, and they'll be turning more people away at the border, essentially.
Regardless of who's president and who's in Congress.
Yeah.
Okay, so it feels like it's not— it feels like it might be a reasonably good forecast, then.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then I guess— what will be driven by the election results, perhaps, is what happens with the number of visas, you know, how many people can come into the country legally. That may vary under both whether you get a Biden or a Trump. And the other thing that may vary is policies with regard to the illegal or undocumented immigrants that are already in the country, right? Because I think former President Trump has been talking about deportation. Now, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
And how quickly these cases are processed through. I mean, right now there's a pretty significant backlog.
Right. And just to state the obvious, I mean, if you have deportation, these are net numbers, right? These are the number of people coming in, less the number of people that are leaving. Right now, there aren't a whole lot of people leaving. But if you had deportation, mass deportation, then you'll get much smaller net inflows or maybe even a negative number, you know, depending on what the magnitude of the deportations are, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, just for point of comparison, in 2019, we had less than 500,000 immigrants coming into the country. So it can definitely make a significant impact who is in the White House.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, this is to be determined and we got to work this through. But in the meantime, you're working really hard to incorporate these new estimates into our own numbers and forecasts.
Yep, and share it down to the state level so we can get a picture going forward there as well.
I mean, why stop at the state, right? I mean,
Adam will tell you. I say state, and I just mean that as in regional. Yeah, state, metro.
That's the next stop on the train, yep. Right? Because this has to go all the way down, right, to metros or counties, metros, the whole way down, doesn't it?
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Well, okay, so you got a lot of work ahead.
Yeah, we have a meeting week after next.
Who's we? Am I in that meeting?
You're in that meeting, yeah.
Okay, all right. We'll figure this out. Yeah, okay. All right, anything else on the, I mean, obviously there's a lot of implications for what it means. You kind of alluded to it in the context of the data. One of the reasons why we have this gap between employment in the payroll survey, the survey of businesses, and the household survey, the survey of households, is that the payroll employment data comes directly from the businesses. And that would include, there's no distinction whether that person that's working is an immigrant or not. Whereas the household surveys, that data is a survey that's benchmarked ultimately to population counts. And those population estimates at the current point in time are the census estimates, not the CBO. And they're therefore undercounting, you know, what's going on in terms of everything, labor force growth, employment growth, everything else. Correct?
Yeah, that's what's part of the big discrepancy in terms of the household survey versus the payroll survey.
Okay.
Numbers.
Okay. All right. I mean, in my view, the one way, the most obvious way to lift the economy's growth rate underlying growth rate, that potential growth rate we talked about at the top of the podcast, is to have rational immigration reform, right? Control the border. I mean, that feels like that's beyond economics. That's a national security issue. You got to control the border. But then after that, have immigration reform that reforms the system in a way that we bring in immigrants into the country that are most beneficial to the country's economic health going forward. And if we do that, that could supercharge growth, raise the economy's potential, and ultimately have enormous benefits to our long-term fiscal problems. I mean, if we can have so much stronger growth here, you know, more people working, more production, higher tax revenue, goes a long way to addressing our long-term fiscal problems. Anybody find umbrage with that? Any disagreement with that statement?
No. And I would say at the state level, that's very stark. Certain states will benefit quite a bit more than others. And I'm talking about big states too, New York, California, and that'll have a significant regional bucks. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Okay. 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 Well, there's a lot to be worked out here. Anything else you want to say, Laura, before we call it a podcast? Anything else?
Nope. And I think I got to let Marissa go pick up her niece. So
yeah, we're going to do that. I just, anything else, Adam, that you want to bring up before we?
I think we covered the highlights.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
I just want to say, call back to my statistic from Zillow. It is asking rents, not effective rents for sure.
Yeah. Which is important. Yeah. That's good to hear. So, so I was kind of sort of right then.
You were right. Yeah.
I was right. Okay. Right.
Yep. Yep.
I always like to hear that. You were right, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Yep. As usual.
But you can always say, Mark, you know, you're wrong. And I have no problem with that, by the way.
It doesn't happen a lot, but
yeah,
good to know that I can take that opportunity when it happens.
Anytime. Okay, Marissa, go get your niece. And guys, Adam, Laura, really appreciate you taking the time with us. And we're going to call this a podcast. Thank you, dear listener. We'll talk to you next week.